Hello everybody. Let me introduce Rose White from New York. And she's going to talk about deviance and the role of deviance in the liberation of society. Please give her a warm applause.
Student in sociology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Today I'm talking about brilliant deviance, by which I mean you and me. And I want to look at how we get ourselves accepted by society, by which I mostly mean work, but also society at large. It's my belief that successfully acting the way that we do, by being geeky and radical and iconoclastic, and yet staying employed and functioning in the world, we make the world at large more accepting of deviance and weirdness. Is the sound okay? It sounds kind of echoey. It's okay? It's not okay. Thank you. Sorry. If we think about somebody like Oscar Wilde, we can acknowledge that while he paid a high price for his deviance, he went to jail for being gay, he also circulated in society and he exposed Victorian England to the idea that a man could be openly gay. But his example didn't make the world change overnight, of course. Alan Turing still had to stay closeted 60 years later, and even so had his life ruined by a morals charge. And even today, people wait years before coming out publicly. But public exposure to the idea that it's possible to function while being deviant, while breaking the basic rules of society, is a deeply radical concept, and one which eventually changes the basic societal rules to allow what was previously deviant to become innocuous and acceptable. Sociologists talk about rule-breaking as deviance. And until the late 1960s, the sociological perspective on rule breakers or deviants was that they were detached from society and without social norms, and were sort of afflicted with anomie, the French word for this. But respected books like Howard S. Becker's Outsiders showed that deviant subcultures were full of rules and social norms, and that innumerable subcultures operate in parallel to mainstream society. Sociologists of deviance have thus understood for decades that deviant subcultures have their own cultural norms that are as nuanced and as meaningful as the ones that are found in the larger society. Unfortunately, although Becker's work was popular at the time, it still remains necessary to reinforce his observations about every subculture of interest. Until that's done, from a sociological and a societal point of view, members of a subculture are those weirdos. Members of our subculture are those weirdos who can't get a date or who don't have lives. I have to note that the photo on the left, the person who posted that, who is not the person with the tattoos, mentioned that she got inundated with comments about the non-conforming HTML. So what makes us geeks? The Oxford American Dictionary defines geek as someone with an eccentric devotion to a particular topic. So there are knitting geeks, or science fiction geeks, or bi-poly gamer geeks. But is that what it is? Or are there other personality traits that make us geeks and that set us apart from mainstream society? Is being a geek a learned trait or an inborn one? Amy Emma Loft obviously has parents who expect her to grow up to be part of their own geek culture. And we can easily imagine that she will grow up to think that the world she lives in, which is full of technologists and hackers and science fiction fans and libertarians, is completely normal. The baby on the right, born in 1971, was an IQ baby, was isolated from any other living examples of geek culture, and yet latched onto every single thing that came my way. I am missing a page. I'm going to keep going. So the point that I was making is that I was fond of comic books and science fiction. And those were not things that came from my parents, but were things that I picked up wherever I found them. And then by the time that I was a teenager, I found the Holy Grail. I couldn't find a good copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide itself, and I actually found one outside, just now. So this is a nice old copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide, and also the restaurant. So Douglas Adams, and then also the TRS-80. So when I was a teenager, in my school of about 500 people, there were like three of us in a gifted class of about 10 who would sit all the time programming in BASIC on this TRS-80. And we were the ones who, even today, well, I'm here, and one of them is a programmer in Florida, and the third, she's a physicist in Colorado. So, you know, out of 500, there were sort of three who were gonna end up being lifelong geeks. But another question I have is whether we get supported by our parents or by our families. So obviously the child on the left has been given a beautiful NASA outfit. The boy on the right, his grandmother knit him a 20-foot Doctor Who scarf because he asked for it. But even when culturally or familially our geekiness isn't supported by our parents, we still find ways to express it. But a friend of mine talks about how there are some mental traits that make us more likely to take certain jobs. And he talks about how, would you want someone who didn't have OCD to write a dictionary? Like, would you want a slacker to write your dictionary? Like, oh, I think that's enough words. No, you want people who are really obsessive and who are going to, you know, do things right. And it's undeniable that there are clusters of, I guess we have to call them psychiatric traits, that we see in our peers. And so there are things like obsessive compulsive disorder, or attention deficit disorder, or oppositional defiant disorder, which is, you know, when you don't play well with authority, or Asperger's syndrome, which many of us are familiar with, and which is a sort of milder form of autism. But what comes first? And why are there more people with those so-called diseases who are part of our geek culture? And do we end up being geeks because there are things about us that lead us that way? And I think these are questions that I'd like to see addressed in either the sociological literature or the more popular literature. This is my friend Kelly Perry. She's fond of saying that she doesn't know anybody who doesn't have ADD. That out of her entire peer group, whether she looks at the people she programs with, the people she challenges square dances with, or the people she sightseeings and she reads tower belts, all of those people have ADD, which of course also allows us to hyper-focus. And so when you look at something that's been labeled by society as a disease, like ADD, or a syndrome, or in any case, a problem, we tend to find that those are adaptive traits, that our ability to hyperfocus, our ability to multitask and to handle a large number of distractions are useful. I see somebody has a question. I'd be happy to answer some questions at the end. Is that okay?
No.
So, do we choose to cluster together because our personality traits sort of direct us toward each other? Or do we become more like each other once we've made our initial connection? In his essay, How to Become a Hacker, Eric S. Raymond says that we should work as intensely as we play and play as intensely as we work. And that for true hackers, the boundaries between play and work and science and art all tend to disappear or to merge into a high-level creative playfulness. And I agree with him entirely on this point, and I want to point out that this kind of lifelong playfulness is extremely subversive to mainstream culture. We're meant to grow up and to put aside childish things, and yet geeks, like my friend, like all of us, revel in our refusal to do so. Geeks know that you don't have to do things the way that society tells you to do them. And so many of us are self-taught, whether not necessarily in our school topics, but in our programming or in our other hobbies. Certainly our hacking was not taught to us by school teachers, but by our peers. Even while the school model of the world insists that learning by rote at the same speed as a group of other people is the way to acquire knowledge. We know that's not true. And throughout our lifespans, we remember that it's exciting to solve problems, and to make things, and to teach people, and to learn anything we need to know to approach a problem that we've been given. We're intolerant of boredom, and we don't do well in overly institutional settings. We're anti-authoritarian. We're even often anti-capitalist. Again, Eric S. Raymond, in the same talk, spoke about hackerdom as a gift culture, which is a term that anthropologists use. And so he said, you gain status and reputation in it not by dominating other people, nor by being beautiful, nor by having things other people want, but rather by giving things away, specifically by giving away your time, your creativity, and the results of your skill. I don't mean to say that we don't ever want to get paid, but it's certainly true that as geeks, we have a different relationship to the prevailing Western culture of capitalism and consumerism. Well, we don't even look like everybody else. Some geeks look like this. And some geeks look like this. But neither Richard Stallman nor Violet Blue is going to walk into a job at an investment bank anytime soon. And so it's okay for them to look like that. And both of them are out there in the world, and they're doing their work, and they're creating our geek culture. And I'm pretty sure they're each happier than they would be if they were working at a bank. I have a number of sociological questions about geekery that aren't being asked currently in the sociological literature. And I'm going to pose them here. And I'm interested in people adding to them. And I'm going to give you my email address again. And if people want to take any of them on, you are welcome to. So first question is, how do we find our communities? So what happens in adolescence when individual people discover science fiction, or higher math, or programming, or robotics? Just the whole wide world of ways to be a geek. And then what happens when, as geeks, we go from being that one person who is the outsider in the school to having a community where there are thousands of people who are like us? And what changes when we go from having outsider status to insider status? What are different geek work cultures like? One thing people could do is look at different sizes and styles of workplaces to see how geek culture gets manifested there. And so I think the looking at a really big firm, a middle-sized firm, am I making terrible microphone noises? I'm sorry. I'll try to be very still. The IT group of a nonprofit or a college and a small startup all have a lot of similar people working for them. What's going on? This next fellow is going to help me out. Oh, there we go. were to look at the culture in each of those kinds of workplaces, we'd see differences, but we'd also see similarities. And that, you know, mainstream society just thinks of all of these people, all of us, as being one sort of person, but we're not just all one sort of person. Another thing somebody can take on is looking at people with the same degree even, but who go into different industries and how their characteristics are different. And so just one example I can think of is how do math or computer science PhDs who go into banking, for instance, differ from people who go into programming? What about their personalities or their backgrounds makes them choose such vastly different fields? Because up until then, you know, they've been smart, they've gone through the same school path, but one set of people pick a very culturally different work environment than the others. Some people say that being a geek is just about being smart, but we know that that's not all. There are so many overlapping deviant subcultures, and as far as I know, nobody's been looking at that. And I want to know, why do some kinds of deviance lead to seemingly unrelated other kinds of deviance? So there's BDSM, there's paganism, there's SF fandom, there's gaming, there's all sorts of stuff. And so why are there plush Cthulhu dolls and pagan jewelry at BDSM fairs where the people walking around are folks wearing black.com t-shirts? Like, why does that cluster? So I want this work to be done, and I'd love to see it done publicly. I could spend a day coming up with another 10 sociological projects that somebody could do. And one of the things that I have found odd about being back in an academic culture is that people seem to think that ideas are expensive, but ideas are so cheap. Like, there's so much of the world that hasn't been discussed and hasn't been looked at properly. And so I would be terribly excited if somebody picked one of these ideas and said, I want to write a thesis on that, or even just, I want to write a paper on it. It's important that these things get talked about, because our culture is real, and we're not anomic outsiders. We belong to a vibrant community. But a lot of what geeks do isn't done in public, and our contributions to society are underappreciated, and even though those are widely used. Our current work on civil liberties and monopoly busting and against DRM is barely noticed at all by the mainstream, even though these are vital political questions right now. Now's a good time for me to give a shout out to Creative Commons licensing, which has brought me the photos I've been using today. So sociologists and more often anthropologists have written a little about hacker or geek culture, but when they've done so, they've mainly written about open source programming. And obviously that's not unrelated to what I'm talking about today, but at the same time I feel that focus really neglects an underlying truth. That writing open source code isn't what makes somebody a geek. And what it's like to be a geek has to do with more than one's day job. And I believe that we have a full, rich, shared culture that has gone far beyond just programming. In fact, I believe that geekery is a social movement, attracting new members at an increasing rate. I believe it makes an economic statement, akin to the sort of foodie culture of eating locally. We want to make what we use. We want the means and the modes of production. We don't want to sit back and only consume. We want control over every aspect of our lives. Over the last few years, the internet has become indispensable for people who had no hand in building it. And many of those people are content to just use the internet as a tool, like some sort of encyclopedia phone book shopping mall that's like all just rolled up into one. But increasingly, exposure to the internet is letting those previously mundane people get a glimpse of what life would be like if they embraced our revolution. So the audience for O'Reilly's magazines, Make and Craft, for instance, is not limited to people who were already readers of O'Reilly's technical books. And the knitters who are populating the social network and database website Ravelry with thousands of photographs and links and reviews and how-tos are creating a new tool on the internet even though very few of them have any ability to code. They're putting information in the world for others to share and learn from just as surely as any open source coder does. And so it turns out that Make and Craft and Ravelry and the internet itself all make the world a little weirder. And by making the world a little weirder and more liberal, they make the world a little safer and a little more accepting of weirdness. And that's what all of us here are doing, and I'm very excited about it. I love the world that we're making. Voldav Voraus. For having to speak extemporaneously in the middle, but I'd love to hear any questions that you have.
Mic on, yeah. Don't be shy. Questions, comments, the spam.
I actually want to encourage people to consider sociology, so I'm spamming you for a second. One of the things that I realized is that having access to different cultures is incredibly valuable to sociology. That the people who come to it just out of college don't have a lot of world experience, and they don't have a lot of other worlds that they can describe. But that if you come to sociology, say in your 30s, after having had a career, you've been out in the world and you know that there are different ways that the world works, and you're able to discuss them and present them to more mainstream society. There's a question in the back earlier, and there's one.
Hello. I'm just wondering if there have been any work on the sort of interaction between people in mainstream culture and the geeky side of it, in that everyone in mainstream culture, you had a slide up with a picture of, no, I won't fix your computer. Everyone in mainstream culture knows a geek.
Right.
And if they have a computer problem or whatever, they go to someone in the geeky subculture.
Uh-huh.
Has there been anything sort of seeing the interaction with this, and are there any ways that we could sort of use this in that we have
right.
to expand upon that, expand upon our influence?
Sure. I know that Michael Schwern, who isn't doing this from a sort of academic context, but just from a being part of the culture context. So I don't know if people know who he is. Michael Schwern is a parole packer who lives out in Oregon. Has been trying to put together stuff about how we communicate both geek to geek and geek to normal. How to translate and work on that.
Hi, I was just wondering, was there a reason why you didn't mention anything regarding gender? Because I know, being a girl myself, as a girl geek, you're usually minority. And you're also sometimes expected to translate between your male friends and the normal world,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. Like,
of course.
Because as being a girl, you're expected to sort of... well, I guess it's an advantage too that you've been raised in a different way and you've learned. You had to learn a lot of, more than rules of the normal society because you're expected to be so different and so.
Mm-hmm.
So have you done any research on that aspect of geekiness?
So Annalee Newitz and Charlie Anders have written a great book called She's Such a Geek. Actually, they edited it and asked for lots of different women's takes on what their experiences have been being geeks. What I took you to mean at first is the role that women geeks often play in translating between their male geek friends and the rest of the world, because there's a sense that women sort of stay more socialized than men do. But one of the points I was making is that it's a mistake to think of geek or hacker culture as not being socialized. We're incredibly socialized. We have all sorts of ways that we expect each other to act and to interact. And those are social rules. They just don't have the same social rules that are in the society at large. The other point you were making about the sort of difficulties of being a girl who is geeky are you know, they're enormous. I don't want to downplay them. I don't know how different it is for somebody who's a teenager now than somebody who was a teenager 20 years ago. But I had a personal experience in a sort of map world of being in a competition where everything was blended so that the people judging didn't know who was handing in answers. And one of the judges said, I would like to speak to contestant B36. And I went up, and he said, damn, you're a girl. And I said, what? And he said, well, I was hoping you'd come to my private school, but I can't take you, you're a girl. And that was pretty upsetting. And that's just a tiny story compared to the things that people go through in their workplaces. Please, I'm wondering if other people have comments, if you have other ideas about sort of aspects of culture that that could get looked at. Because, sure, thank you.
It seems to me that even in the language you're using, we're sort of adopting the sort of derogatory terms for apparently what is our culture, and sort of acknowledging that, you know, the mainstream, which we then define as normal, is normal. And I think we should just turn it around and saying, look, you know, we are the engineers, the technicians, the builders of all the new things. You know, we are the political activists to make sure that, you know, civil liberties stay in touch with the people that you refer to as normal, and that probably refer to themselves as normal, really tend to be sheeple and part of the problem. And I really think we should turn it around. You know, I mean, we are not the problem here. We are part of the solution.
I love your point. I think that's a wonderful point.
I think we should be a bit more proud of what we are. I would apologize for it. Or maybe just switch off the internet every now and then and see how that
sure,
goes.
Yeah. The thing that I feel like I'm just scratching the surface in this talk is trying to point out the dramatic effect that we have on culture, or can have on culture. And so while I've used sort of currently appropriate terms like normal and geek to set apart two different groups, or mainstream and geek, that I didn't mean that to imply what I think ought to be the case. You certainly, you're the mainstream for me. This is who I hang out with, and this is who I see on a day-to-day basis. I would love to see the world become more active in all sorts of ways. And so that hint of maker culture that O'Reilly's trying to promote, I see as terrific. And if more people decided that they could, break by opening the objects that they own and tinkering with them, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, hello. I have a question. You mentioned the importance.
Oh, there you go. Sorry.
You mentioned the importance of the support of the family, and you showed this picture of the small girl in a NASA suit.
Yeah.
So I would like to know if that's of the general culture, how important is that? For example, a student in Germany or a young person in Germany or in Singapore, there might be completely different expectations from the family and how they would develop. There's a higher pressure of conforming to these expectations, maybe in different cultures. And is there a big difference like in the development of geek cultures, even between, say, Germany and the US or even the Asian cultures? And I would like to get your opinion on that.
There are huge cultural differences, and that's I really should have highlighted at the beginning that I was talking from my own perspective as an American about American examples. I don't know personally what the differences are like in countries where children are more heavily streamed into which high school courses they take, or if they are pushed to be high performing. Whether that makes it less appealing to involve yourself in other geeky pursuits. In the United States, I think that fooling around with your computer and breaking things in and exploiting things and putting all those things back together has so little to do with what we get taught in American high schools that it can be this kind of subversive outsider role. I don't know how to compare German culture or the different Asian cultures and, you know, their expectations of schooling.
To know what you think about the role of the TV.
Mm-hmm.
That, how should I say this? I think when you are kind of lost in your childhood, you look at the TV and you see the nerd being bashed on
right.
TV, and you kind of look at him and you think, I like him.
Mm-hmm.
So how important is this nerd as the people who make TV see it, and how we kind of start to look like what we see on TV, or is it the other way around? Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So,
I know that I rarely have ever seen on television people sort of accurately portrayed as geeks or nerds. They don't really seem like my people to me. They seem like some sort of weird caricature of, you know, somebody who just can barely dress themselves and who, you know, doesn't bathe and, you know, just stacks cans and, you know, and not that some of us don't stack cans, but the point that I'm making is that I think that, you know, Hollywood or whichever, you know, set of screenwriters make up these kind of ideas, and I think they do have a negative effect for some people in that they don't want to be that fat. And I think in other ways, perhaps it's sort of, can be inspirational because you think, oh, well, I'm not going to let people keep me down. I'm going to rise up and do cool things anyway.
Thinking about geeks in the TV, I always have to think about Radar from Mesh. What I wanted to say is, is it measurable? So you could say, if I have, I don't know, an IQ, hemorrhage, and special grade in sports, you can say this person is 90%, this person is 100%. I mean, does that correlate?
I don't know if it correlates. I think that, I don't know if it's measurable. I'm sure there's some people who would be interested in trying to do that kind of measuring, but I'm not sure what they can find out. The idea that geeks are bad at sports, for instance, I think comes about because of this interest in team sports, which tend to be incredibly authoritarian and have a sort of coach and a structure and a way that of interacting that just doesn't fit very well personality-wise. Whereas many of the geeks that I know turn out to really like long-distance running, or taekwondo, or aikido, or something, where they are themselves able to control their progress, and, you know, I know geek weightlifters who keep, you know, incredibly detailed spreadsheets of what it is that they, you know, what they've lifted, and how many reps, and everything. And so the idea that we don't like being in our bodies, for instance, is a fallacy. It's just that the sort of cultural expectation, at least in America, is that in school, if you're going to be physical, you're going to be on a sports team. As for IQ, I personally have a sort of vague idea that, you know, if you're high normal, that those are the people who are very bright and sort of get along well in society, but don't stick out. And so maybe they're like the quarterback on the high school football team and, you know, become businessmen or something, and that then, like, if you go up a few notches, that's when people start to not fit in as well because they have a lot of very different ideas about, like, how society should work and aren't as happy to just go along, which I personally see as a good thing, but can be uncomfortable if you're in adolescence.
Would you agree that we don't interact socially as it is expected by mainstream society because it's too high overhead for us and we are basically too smart and want to cut edges and talk faster than everybody else?
I would agree that that happens. I know that some people are able to, you know, tone it down and, you know, make it work, either because they have a relative that they still want to talk to, or because, you know, they want to not get hit in the face at the supermarket. But, you know, I've also certainly known and that dated and left a geek who was completely intransigent about his need to always be smarter than everyone else. And so if, like, the clerk couldn't cope with, like, what the complicated change algorithm he'd come up with, you know, because he'd be like, oh, well, I've given you 20 and 57 cents so that you can give me back a 5 and as far as he was concerned, he was maximizing how the situation worked. And the clerk would just be staring at him. What the fuck are you doing? And he would leave those situations frustrated and feeling like, well, why was she so mean to me? So, you know, sometimes we are misfits. You know, I can't deny that. But I'm not sure where I was headed with that. But it happens.
So I think experience shows us that mainstream culture always wants to or tends to suck up and exploit like deviant culture. So what will happen to geek culture in the future? Will mainstream society maybe embrace it some more, and what becomes of geek culture then? Because if, like, in 20 years half of the people are what we call geeks now, what has changed, or will that happen? Because if you show children in, like, Star Trek suits, or they now tend to grow up as geeks, so how will society change?
I don't know, and that's a really interesting question. I think that you're asking sort of two questions. The individuals that I show pictures of who are being sort of supported in their geekiness with their, you know, NASA outfit or the 20-foot scarf are individuals. I don't think that they're examples of a larger societal trend toward children taking on geeky physical characteristics or you know, fashion traits. If people did, and as you point out, that mainstream culture often appropriates from subcultures. So in the way that, you know, there are kids walking around wearing sort of black leather and spikes and stuff who are really very punk rock. You know, what would it mean if kids were wearing sort of blinged out flash drives or, you know, I don't know what else. I think it'd be fun to see. Maybe, you know, we get picked on this. And so thank you so much for coming today. I really appreciate it.